Welcome to the March 2019 Rehab Cast from the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. I'm your host, Dr. Ford Box. Now, this month's Rehab Cast features a great study out of UAB and the Lakeshore Foundation on movement to music in adapted yoga for multiple sclerosis. We're going to be talking with Professor James Rimmer about the study shortly. Now, some of the hottest news in the MS field concerns a form of stem cell treatment that's being studied at Northwestern, Duke, and a variety of international locations. And it's the subject of an ethically dubious pay-to-play form of research, some of which is supported by online crowdfunding campaigns. Recently, promising findings were published in JAMA, where patients underwent a procedure called partial immune ablation, followed by hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. In this procedure, your autologous hematopoietic stem cells are collected, your immune system is suppressed via chemotherapy, and then the stem cells are reintroduced. The new stem cells migrate to the bone marrow and over time can reconstitute the immune system. Some patients have reportedly had to pay upwards of $100,000 to participate in these types of trials, raising important questions about this type of study, including how much that could influence the results. The findings in the JAMA study are impressive, with far fewer cases of MS progression in the stem cell transplant group compared to usual therapy. Now, some of the usual therapies in the trial were older. Disease progression occurred in just 3 patients in the transplant group and 34 patients in the traditional disease-modifying therapy group, with a median follow-up of 2 years. But what further clouds the study, though, is an FDA warning letter sent to lead author Dr. Bird of Northwestern. As reported on the website Vox.com, the letter contains a long list of violations of the federal regulations that govern research involving humans. These include the failure to report deaths to the FDA in one study in a timely manner. Dr. Burt says this violation did not relate to the MS study, but another lupus study. The failure to evaluate the side effects that patients experienced and to report them to the FDA on time, and the failure to do interim analysis of study data as promised in a study plan. Now, shockingly, JAMA says it didn't know about the letter at the time of submission, acceptance, or publication. They only learned about it after publication. Now, here's a study for which there are no FDA warning letters, to say the least. Now, turning to our interview straight from the pages of the archives. So joining us now on the Rehab Cast is Professor James Rimmer. Dr. Rimmer is a professor in the School of Health Professions at UAB in Birmingham, and he is also director of research at the Lakeshore Foundation, where he's an endowed chair in health promotion and rehabilitation sciences. Dr. Rimmer, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
The partnership between UAB, which has its own rehab hospital, and the private Lakeshore Hospital and Foundation. Tell us about that for a minute and how that has blossomed over time.
Yeah, well, about 20 years ago, the Foundation had a large endowment and it decided that they needed to pivot from focusing most of its work on the rehabilitation end of the continuum and more towards what they referred to as the transition from rehabilitation into wellness. And so they decided to build a 100,000 square feet health and fitness facility that includes a number of different exercise areas, 2 indoor swimming pools, 1 heated at 95 degrees. They have 3 professional sized basketball courts. So we get several tournaments a year. We host several tournaments a year, wheelchair basketball tournaments. They also have an indoor track. They have a fitness center. They have a shooting range. We have military programs here, so shooting is a big part of that program. And we're adding a new addition this year, a 16,000 square foot addition, which will include a culinary lab or kitchen, mindfulness room, and a clinical exercise room. So the foundation is primarily focused on providing people with disabilities in the Birmingham community and sometimes nationally with state-of-the-art exercise wellness programs.
Wow, that does sound pretty impressive. Now, you were recruited down from Illinois in 2012 to come be this new endowed chair for this partnership. And there I see you had a career. You were you worked with you were based in Champaign, but also had work with the Rehab Institute of Chicago, and were a professor there. And your career extends for a long period. You've been involved in a lot of different things with regards to disability research over time, and started out as a PhD in kinesiology. Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of arc of your career?
So I started as an adapted physical education teacher in a public school system back in the mid-70s in New York City. And there became very interested in, as an exercise physiology major, kinesiology student, I became very intrigued with the health and function of people with disabilities. And interestingly, physical therapy was an option at that time, but I was really more on the side of wanting to do things in the community. I felt that sports and recreation were critical pieces that were missing in the lives of these young children that I was working with. So I went on and got a master's degree in adapted physical activity, and then from there went on for a PhD in exercise science with a specialization in disability. And in those days, in the late 70s, early 80s, there was probably maybe five or six people in the world who really tried to mesh or combine exercise physiology with disability. In fact, some of the early research, I spent a lot of time in the library with a lot of quarters trying to Xerox anything. Those days it was called Xerox, today it's photocopy. But I would Xerox anything I could get my hands on related to disability and exercise. And of course, one of the biggest countries to work in this area was Sweden. And there was a lot of interest in work on children with cerebral palsy. So I started off, you know, really Xeroxing those articles. And then from there, you know, my interest grew into looking more at how does the built environment really affect people with disabilities. So instead of displacing, you know, all of my focus on, you know, looking at specific clinical measures associated with an intervention, you know, I decided that it was really critical for us to start to look at how can we make the community more universally accessible so people could participate in sports, recreation, you know, wherever they chose to do so.
And as the American population is living longer and incurring more disability over the course of the lifespan, this type of research and its implementation becomes that much more important.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Venn diagram, which shows, you know, there's a real overlap of what people with disabilities need compared to what the aging or older adult population needs. So we really see this now starting to blossom. Things like complete streets, a little bit longer time, traffic lights are a little bit longer, more sensitive to the gait patterns or the slower gait patterns of people. And we're starting to see a little bit more in the fitness industry and being more conscious about trying to purchase equipment that has a few more elements of accessibility. So this is a good time for people with disabilities because of the aging demographics.
Mm-hmm. Now, the specific disability at hand here in this study is, of course, multiple sclerosis. And that is a population for which you and the Lakeshore Foundation, I see, have acquired a PCORI grant that you're working on. I gather this study in and of itself may not be directly related to the PCORI grant, which seems to be more telehealth related, and this is more in person, although I could see that you might want to transition this to a telehealth model in future. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So our PCORI grant is a telerehabilitation program that was created by an occupational therapist, and it has three components. It has a section on Pilates, then there's a second section on yoga, adapted yoga exercise, and a third section is dual tasking activities. And so the program is a 20-session intervention, really, really nicely laid out professional videography. And what we do is we give people tablets, PCs, people with MS, and they go home and they have a tablet and a tablet stand, and then they do these exercises over a 12-week period, 2 days a week for the first 8 weeks, and then once a week for the last 4 weeks. And we're comparing that to an on-site program. So the other group of participants, they actually go to a clinic, a physical therapy clinic, where they get the same exact intervention by a therapist. And so our proposal or our hypothesis is that because there are so many challenges associated with getting to clinics for people with MS, particularly those who can no longer drive or those who have difficulty leaving the home because they have a higher level of impairment, you know, the hypothesis is that we'll see no difference in the outcomes between people who do the tele-rehab program compared to those who receive the intervention in a clinical setting. The project, the study that we're discussing today that was published in Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation has a little different twist. Instead of it being, you know, a little bit more on the rehab side, tele-rehab side, this is more of an in-person program that's based and created by a group of dancers who took the elements of dance, adapted it in terms of its tempo and its rhythm and timing and things of this nature, and then created a 3-day-a-week, 12-week program, which is being offered on site.
And so, yes, this specific study, it's entitled The Effects of M2M, or Movement to Music, and an Adapted Yoga on Physical and Psychosocial Outcomes in People with Multiple Sclerosis. And I suppose y'all are emphasizing their movement to music rather than dancing in particular, because, you know, we're not necessarily talking about choreographed dances or ballroom dancing in particular, if folks may have some significant disabilities. You do talk about the fact that there is, you know, a burgeoning literature on music therapy in a variety of conditions. And in fact, we here on the Rehab Cast have previously discussed some forms of music therapy, even kind of some Irish step dancing for Parkinson's disease, which shows promising results. And so it's not surprising to see it translated into some other neurodegenerative conditions. So had you and your group done some music therapy type interventions in this and other populations before this study?
No, you know, this was actually funded in 2013 from NIDLR, the National Institute on Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research. And, you know, the concept came about because, well, a couple of reasons. One, my wife is a dancer. You know, she still takes dance, even in her 60s, ballet classes 3 days a week. So, you know, my thought was, knowing that dance has, you know, tremendous potential for creating a sense of body awareness and body control, and of course various health outcomes. And so we began to think about this with a young lady who I think you contacted, Dr. Zoe Young, who's out of the country. And I found out from her that she was a classical ballerina in Taiwan. And so the planets came aligned. I ended up coming down here from Chicago with my wife. I became very intrigued in how movement and music could be blended in some sort of a fusion so that it could take the elements of classical dance like ballet, modern dance, tap dance, African dance, Latin dance. You know, was there a way to strip out all those elements and then put them back together in a very systematic structure to allow people with disabilities to engage in movement patterns that would be health enhancing? So that was the major thing, is how do we strip out the core elements of all movement? Because if you look at movement, whether it's ballet or tap or jazz or modern, you know, they all have different movement patterns. Sometimes it's a hop, sometimes it's a slide, you know, a step, you know, moving the arms in one fashion. Sometimes you move the arms bilaterally, sometimes you move them unilaterally. How do you move with other people? So it was really intriguing that when Dr. Young came, we sat down and we came up with an acronym called MAPIT, which stands for Modality, Adaptation, Position, Pattern, Equipment, Time, and Tempo. And from that structure, we were able to lay out or strip out several different forms of dance into, you know, this particular modality would be good for working on strength versus something else where some activity was being done across the floor, then that would be more aerobic. So that's your modality. The adaptations were, you know, some people are not going to be able to do it standing. Some people aren't going to be able to do it for a long period of time. So it's adapted for the individual. And then we get into the pattern. So the pattern is, you know, are you going to do two sets with the right leg and three sets with the left leg? Are you going to do it standing, sitting? That's the whole pattern of movement. The position is standing, sitting, and sometimes a combination of standing with assistance with a ballet bar. You have equipment. Sometimes it's free weights or ankle weights. Sometimes it's just using another type of device that they hold while they're performing the movement. And of course, time and tempo has everything to do with the rhythm. How quickly, you know, the cadence, how quickly do they move? So when we stripped this out and came up with this acronym, MAPIT, we realized that, you know, there were really literally hundreds of different movement patterns that we could tailor to people with specific disabilities. The second reason we did it is because we found that there was a real void in the literature for activities that were done to music. As you mentioned, you know, there are specific disability-specific programs like Parkinson's for dance that is specifically designed for people with Parkinson's. But what we were hoping to do is develop a movement-based program with music that would be more interesting and engaging. So just like all of us, when I go out and walk or I go for a short run, you know, I don't want to listen to the same music over and over and over again, right? Every couple of weeks, I'm uploading, you know, some new tunes on Amazon Prime or Spotify. Well, it's the same way with movement. We assume that people are going to really enjoy riding a stationary bike for the rest of their lives. And it doesn't work that way. You know, it's not engaging. It's not interactive. It's not immersive. So we decided that this music was a good way to get people a variety, because what you could do is you could keep the same movement patterns, mix them up, and then you could try different music. And with different music, it becomes, again, much more engaging when they participate in the activity.
Well, that's great. Yeah. And I suppose there's an addendum here that outlines some of those specific movement patterns and everything that you guys have organized as well.
Yeah, we have a very comprehensive manual of operating procedures, mm-hmm. and it's all in there. In fact, the good news is that we were just refunded for another 5 years to translate this study into the YMCA. So now we're working intimately with five YMCAs. The study just started last month, and we're going to now translate or move this movement to music program outside of Lakeshore and into the YMCAs.
And of course, the other important thing about this study, which is so often not done, unfortunately, is, you know, comparing it to some other type of intervention where people spend a similar amount of time with engaged therapists and so forth. So they get all those added benefits of the group participation and engagement in something versus just, you know, being entirely on a wait list or so forth and not active at all. And then it makes it very difficult to parse out in these studies, you know, how much is really this intervention versus just kind of all the additive things that someone gets from going into a group program like this. And y'all chose adapted yoga, which in and of itself has a growing literature in rehabilitation and is showing some interesting effects in a variety of conditions. I suppose, and including adaptive yoga, you know, what was your going-in hypothesis? Did you necessarily expect that it was going to be inferior to movement to music, or did you think that you might have some difficulty parsing out the effects there?
Well, you know, we were thinking that I'm a big fan of yoga. I think it has enormous potential benefits, particularly for those who have really a lot of joint discomfort from running, any kind of pounding. If there's any, you know, risk associated with that, people with fibromyalgia, multiple sclerosis, stroke, you know, adapted yoga is really a great activity. But what I see missing in yoga is what we do so much in exercise physiology. We focus on the aerobic component or the cardiorespiratory component. And so certainly that's what we found in this study is adapted yoga, you know, might be good, you know, for maybe looking at improvements in balance or even strength, isometric strength. But our major goal here was to look at two primary outcomes, which was one was the timed up and go, which is really a measure of good balance while moving, right? Which we know movement to music, you're moving more than you are in yoga with it, where there's a lot more stationary positions. And then the other thing that was significant was the timed, the 6-minute walk test really was, you know, showed great improvements. So we like the idea of movement to music complementing yoga, but certainly the literature is quite convincing that people need to do moderate activity at least 30 minutes a day, and movement to music is more on that spectrum. It's really focused on trying to get people to a level of fitness that is part of the U.S. national physical activity guidelines, 30 minutes a day of moderate to moderate physical activity, about 150 minutes a week. This particular project, really does reach that threshold of endurance.
So y'all had that good result on the timed up and go and the 6-minute walk test. There was this other test of the so-called 5-time sit to stand test, and that one did not prove to have a significant change. Can you tell me about why y'all included that one as well? That a little bit more endurance perhaps involved there, and why you think that wasn't as effective?
Yeah, we probably put a lot more emphasis on the aerobic component, of course, which is not strength oriented. The aerobic side of this, we had a little bit of strength, a lot of muscular endurance. But when you look at the 5-time sit to stand, it's rock bottom. You have to have enough leg strength to sit and stand, in your chair. So again, it's one of those stationary movements that is not as receptive to a cardiorespiratory endurance program where you're at a lower intensity threshold, but you want those muscles to be activated for a period of time. So a lot of our aerobic activities are 10 minutes in length. And so there's not a heavy emphasis on, overloading the muscles. So we think that may be one reason, is the focus was not there.
I see. The symptom of fatigue, which is certainly omnipresent in MS, more or less, and as y'all point out, multifactorial, that symptom of itself didn't really show a relationship with what group people were in. I suppose maybe that wasn't too much of a surprise.
No, it wasn't. Once again, our focus was more on the cardio side of it, and we added these secondary measures with the once again, the assumption that if someone has better cardiorespiratory endurance, they're going to have a lower fatigue score. But it didn't have any relationship in this study to lowering fatigue.
Now, the adapted yoga, no effect on any of the measures that were significant. Have there been other yoga studies in MS, to your knowledge, and do they also have kind of null effects?
No, actually, on the contrary, there are a few studies that have been done with people with MS, and most of the studies that I've read have shown positive outcomes, again, mostly on improving balance and strength. I don't think I've seen very much literature on cardiorespiratory improvements through yoga, but certainly strength and balance have improved. So again, we don't want to, I'm hoping that as a result of this study, people don't become dissuaded about using adapted yoga for people with MS. I think it's a great intervention. But if you're focused on really looking at the cardiac and the respiratory system or circulatory system, and you're trying to get more movement across a period of time, like 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes, then you've got to develop movement patterns that people can do for that length of time.
Right, and of course the types of improvements that you're seeing, walking, timed up and go, and so forth, those really do and again, not to denigrate yoga and its balance effects that may help prevent a fall or so forth, but really that increased mobility is something that's going to help prevent further advancement of disability.
Precisely, and when you look at the videos of movement to music, it does exactly that. There's a lot of stepping. You got to step to the right, step to the left. There's a little bit of even that aerobic dance component, where you might be using a certain pattern, 2 steps to the right, 2 steps with the opposite leg backwards. Now turn around. Now let's go forward. So there's a lot of that where they've got to really process what the pattern is. The teacher, the instructor is doing it with them, but you've got to do this with a certain time and tempo. So there's a lot of central processing, executive function, thinking about which leg do I need to move? Do I move right? Do I move left? how many times do I move forward versus backwards, et cetera, et cetera. So we think that because we had such a predominance of focus on the cardiorespiratory health, that we probably, you know, didn't focus as much on trying to, you know, really see significant improvements in some of the other measures.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking at some of your study limitations in terms of kind of not knowing exactly what people were in the waitlist control and stuff were doing and that type of thing, one thing that crossed my mind, which seems to maybe ebb and flow with the rehab literature, is some form of at-home tracking through, you know, actigraphy and pedometers and things like that. What are your thoughts about how much that type of information could augment a study like this in order to kind of further break down who it seems to be benefiting most, or if people's activity levels overall are improving over the study, and that type of thing?
Yeah, I do think that if we're going to use these short-term interventions, you know, to recommend long-term usage and benefits, then we do have to have a better longer period of time. Our focus here was more on the clinical end of it. You know, we had to look at, you know, the usability of the movement to music structure, you know, the 3 days a week. You know, we did learn that, you know, on average, we only hit about a 66% attendance rate. So on average, participants came 2 to 3 days a week, which in some respects is a fairly good finding, because, you know, you can do it for 24 versus 36 sessions. And theoretically, you know, you should still see quantitatively almost the same level of improvement that we saw with a 3 day a week program. Because as you know, with multiple sclerosis, you know, when they don't feel well on any given day, that there's a tendency to not come to class. So you have to expect that. Now, what we have done since then is this waitlist control group, which was reported in the study, we have offered them a one-on-one home-based training program. So the third leg of this study was to look at the potential of using the movement to music at home. And so we're just getting ready to finish that study. It should be done sometime in April. And it's a 12-week study, 36 sessions, the same exact movement patterns. But instead of the participant having to come in, they work through a sort of like a go-to meeting platform, and they get one-on-one training with an instructor. And I'm very I just can't wait to look at that data, because there are a lot of unique features. It's one-on-one training. You know, the session attendance is much better, because even if they don't feel well, they don't have to leave the house, so they usually are compliant, and they don't like missing, because they know that this is, you know, their personal trainer. So we did use that as our third study. Our first study was just tracking longitudinally health outcomes of people with multiple sclerosis and a couple of other disability groups. And then the second study was this clinical study that was just published. And then the third study, which we're finishing up, is really this home-based tele-exercise program.
Now, are you having much success, or is it part of the mission of the Lakeshore Foundation to kind of implement some of these research findings? It would seem to me that perhaps a movement to music class, incorporating that as part of what this, you know, grand new center does, might be a relatively minimal cost. There's probably a variety of other types of classes and programming going on there. Do you all have that type of translational relationship with, in terms of kind of how the community programming is working?
Yeah, well, you hit a sweet spot there, because they, as soon as we reported the findings to the Lakeshore Foundation, they immediately wanted to set up a new class, a new program.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm.
However, right after that study was published, you know, we heard about this new five-year project, this translational mm-hmm. study of taking it into the Y. So, because, as you know, there's always a limitation in how many participants you can get. You know, we kind of asked Lakeshore if it was okay if we could hold off, since we are going to be running the study at Lakeshore for the first year and a half, 2 years, while we train the YMCA instructors to do so. So we're going to be using their space anyway. We'll be randomizing groups of people who could be members, as long as they meet the eligibility criteria, Lakeshore members. If we didn't get funded, and this would have already been institutionalized, but now with this new funding, we want to get it titrated right down to the level of science that will allow us to know exactly what is going on, in this particular intervention group. The other thing we're doing is we're expanding the group of people, and rather than focusing just on a specific disability per class, we learned from the last iteration that, you know, in some respects, it may be easy to do this by function. So this particular new study is we've got three groups of people. One group will be doing only sitting, movement to music, activities sitting. One group will have the standing and sitting combination. And then we've also identified that there's such a large stroke population, we're going to have a specific movement to music class just for people with hemiparesis, right or left side.
Well, that's really great to hear, and I'm glad you all have such support from the Lakeshore Foundation. They're eager to take the ball and run with it, and it looks like, yeah, this is going to happen one way or another. Well, hopefully a lot of other folks are interested now, having heard this episode of the podcast, and of course, check out the paper itself in this month's archives. Dr. Remmer, I'm glad to hear that you're drilling down further, and we're really going to get to the meat of the matter in terms of for which populations this is most impactful and which elements of it and so forth. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And that's it for this month's RehabCast from the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. Please join us again next month for another fascinating study and in-depth interview ripped straight from the pages of the archives.
Join us in Chicago this fall for ACRM 2019, the largest interdisciplinary rehabilitation conference in the world. The main core conference and pre-conference instructional courses deliver 6 jam-packed days of evidence-based educational content for the whole rehab team, as well as patients and their caregivers. Please visit acrm.org for more information and follow hashtag ACRM 2019.